This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 304 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. So, announcements this week. I don't know how big of an announcement it is, because it's not really pertaining to the season they're currently filming. However, Matt B. Roberts posted a picture on Twitter this week showing his copy of Breath of Snow and Ashes, which had a bunch of rainbow-colored flags in it.
Like four, right?
No, like 100 billion. And and if you zoom in on this picture, you can read some of them. And some of them say things like first sermon and blank is pregnant. And point being, it's a fun little kind of like an Easter eggy kind of adventure if you go find the picture and just zoom in. And somebody, and I don't remember who, went through the trouble of not only zooming in so you could read the ones that were facing the camera, but flipped the image so that you could read the ones that were backwards.
Oh, that's funny.
Seriously, it was amazing. So if you just go to Twitter, I'm sure you'll find it, but Matt B. Roberts posted it this week. It's exciting because we know what's coming for not season 5, but season 6.
Oh my goodness. It means they've already started breaking down, which makes
they
or
have
at least
two, which is planning, important, yeah. Right? And there, I promised you, there are so many flags. It makes me sad to know that not all of them. When you put a flag in there, it means it's an important plot point, right? Why else put it there? But you know some of those plot points are not going to make it. Like, it is feathered. Pure, like, sheer feathered with, like,
it's like a curtain.
Flags.
It's a flag curtain.
It's crazy. Yeah. It's, like, almost from the beginning of the book to the end, it's, like, every other page has a flag on it. It's intense.
And it's not just because it's a big book. Because it is the – I looked at the page numbers and I looked at the hours, the time it took Davina to record it. Mm-hmm. To read it. It is just by a hair the longest of the 8 in both pages and hours.
Good God.
So it's not just long, so you have a lot of things to cover or a lot of things to potentially include and break down. This is also, like, it's kind of ridiculous. There's so, I mean, you can say that about, like, any of the books and you would not be wrong. But I think having just finished, like, I'm on book 8 now of my own personal read along, of my own personal read through. And when I was listening to book 6, I was like, what? Not because it surprised me, but I was like, oh, that's right. This too, like, there, I honestly think, even though the character numbers go up and, like, the storylines, this is not necessarily a spoiler, but in book 7 is not so much. But in book 8, didn't we talk about this before? There's, like, 8 stories.
There are. It's an Octothorpe.
Well, that's why it was an Octothorpe. So yeah, there are 8 storylines, I guess, or passages, whatever, arcs that you're following. So that's a lot.
It's 8 main characters. Character story plots.
Yes. So I'm not saying there aren't more, like, it's possible, because I haven't finished it most recently, it's possible that book 8 has, you know, more stuff than book 6. But knowing where they start in book 6, they have so, I thought, oh, okay, there's this high point, and then this, like, titillating whatever.
Tell me about your titillating whatevers.
No. So I don't think since book, so 2 is sad, 3 is, like, I mean, it's adventurous. 4 is them getting to them building in the new world. I honestly don't think, even though there's bad stuff and good stuff that happens in every single book and all the seasons thus far, I honestly don't think any other book, even eight and even seven, I don't think any other book has as much shiz happen in it.
Than 6?
The sheer number of shiz things. I mean, it's really bad. It's an awesome book, but it's really bad. So
I don't envy anyone having to adapt it.
No. Nope. Out of all the books, well, thus far, I honestly think six would be, people would say 5 would be the hardest, but 5, the thing is, you just cut down the gathering and you've got a lot more time.
I know that we only have the actors for as long as we can keep them. And they are, I think they're itching at the bit, or what is it, whatever that, gnashing,
jumping at the bit
to do other things. However, I kind of feel like that book is long enough that they could split it into multiple seasons. But in the interest of keeping all of the main cast present, I think they're not going to be able to do that, which also makes me a little sad.
Yeah, we shall see. We shall see. And it the way six ends, no spoilers. I mean, I'm not going to say if it's happy or sad, but the way six ends, it could be just like the way it's different than eight. But like the way one ends and like the way one ends, although that's a happy book, right? That's a happy ending. Six and eight are both potential series ending books, storylines. Like it or don't like it, they're both potential enders. Of course, we know there's two more books to come that she said. But as far as where the books end or where the show ends, you could end it at six. That's all I'm going to say. Or if we get to eight, you could end it at eight. That's all I'm going to say. Doesn't mean everything is tied up happily as you might like it, but it's a place to end.
All right. And now on to our read along. This week we will be discussing chapter 35 entitled Hogmanay. And this is probably the last time we record one chapter at a time. Now, that's not true. We have one in a couple of weeks that's really long.
No, there's a few. There's freaking long. Yeah, like 26 or 27 pages. Hogmanay is such a huge event on the ridge that people are coming from all over, even beyond the ridge, to celebrate there. They clean up the barn to make room for dancing. Evan Lindsay plays the fiddle and Murdo Lindsay plays the wooden flute and Kenny Lindsay was on the boron. Thurlow Guthrie on the pipes. Man, these names. I thought I'd heard a lot. I don't know that I heard Thurlow. Thurlow played either the Willen or Illen pipes. Now, I know that there's actually more than two types of pipes, but in the Celtic world, two main types of bagpipes are used. There are many varieties of instruments known as bagpipes. Now, this comes from cranfordpub.com, and there are many varieties of instruments known as bagpipes throughout Europe and parts of Asia, but in the Celtic world of the British Isles, there are two main types. The Irish, which is what Thurlow was playing, the Willen, Illen, or elbow. That's what it means, elbow. And the Scottish pipes, which are known as the Great Highland or Small Border. Now, how do we distinguish between them? The Great Highland bagpipe is probably the most prolific bagpipe worldwide today, due in no small part to the vast extent of the British Empire in the 19th century. The bag is blown full from the player's mouth through a blowpipe, and the pressure from the left arm on the bag sends and controls the flow of air to the melody chanter and three drones. The range of tones which can be produced from the eight small holes in the chanter is limited to only nine, spanning an octave and a tone or second. The sound is produced when the air is forced through a small double-sided reed made traditionally from cane and more recently from plastic. Because the pipe is mouth-blown, the air is laden with moisture and operates in a damp state. The tonic notes are pitched about B-flat, and the scale includes a flat seventh. The limited scale and melodic possibilities, as well as the ever-present drones, give the music both haunting and mesmerizing characteristics, which I think all of us would agree. Now, the Willen or Illen elbow pipes of the Irish tradition are quite a different matter. As the name suggests, they are blown from a bellows located on the right arm. And again, the air is collected and controlled from a bag under the left arm. Pressure on the bag feeds the air to the reeds of the melody chanter, as many as three drones and three regulator stocks, each fitted with keys, which can provide occasional or constant chordal accompaniment. Now, the Highland chanter is always open at the end, and thus the melody is continuous. The Irish chanter operates principally in a closed fashion, making it possible to stop the sound, often imperceptibly. Now, this allows for a vastly different fingering technique, which can produce a wide variety of melodic and ornamental effects. So, Diana if you, I don't know if you caught it when you read it. It took me like two or three meetings of this. Diana is kind when she says that they're at the, in the barn at the celebration. She is kind when she says that they were sometimes, meaning the pipes, were sometimes in harmony, sometimes not. She meant with the fiddle and the wooden flute. And what does that mean? If they're sometimes in harmony, sometimes in not. That is the word, the big D word that I've used so much over the last four seasons, dissonance. If something is not in harmony, or which means obviously like a third, a fourth, maybe a fifth, a sixth, you know, some kind of even, not even, but some kind of step.
Like an interval.
Yeah, thank you. Some kind of interval, regular interval above the melody or some musical line. If it's not a pleasing sound, then it's usually going to be dissonant. And probably the easiest, I think that the three most dissonant sounds or intervals would be a half step, a minor second, a major second, and then an augmented fourth, which is a tritone, if I'm not mistaken. So tritone was also known as the devil's interval, the devil's tone, I think in the medieval era. But because it's not, it's just not, you hear it and you're like, it's if it's played together with its root. So yeah. Anyway, that's what dissonance is. If you hear something and it makes you go,
okay, it doesn't make you do that. That sounded inappropriate.
Sorry.
If it just sets your teeth on edge or makes the hair on the back of your head raise in a bad way.
The thing about dissonance is you need two tones.
I don't know, Ginger. I believe in you.
Yeah, but that typically can't be one note, right? It needs to be a minimum of two. Well, no, if you hear a note, just one note with nothing else, I mean, it's a note. There's nothing, someone may not sing it well, it may not be played well, but from what my ear understands and what I understand musically and harmonically, in order to have dissonance, you need to have something that is out of step, out of line, and that is not the most wonderful terminology, but you need to have at least two tones. Because if it's just one tone, there's nothing to compare it to and thus create disharmony or dissonance. So anyway, just a little bit. This is what Diana writes, quote, "The melody of his chanter sometimes agreed with Lindsay's notion of a particular tune and sometimes didn't. But the overall effect was cheerful, and sufficient whiskey and beer had been taken by this point in the festivities that no one minded in the least," unquote. I just thought it was great. So the next time I hear someone, I hear dissonance that's not on purpose, I'm going to say, those two, you know, or if I hear someone who has some, you know, something that goes off key slightly, but for the most part does, you know, decently well, then I think I'm going to use some of Diana's language. I'm going to say, sometimes they agreed, sometimes they didn't.
They say that about us a lot.
But we're not singing much often.
No, but even when we talk.
Claire gets dizzy from dancing and Jamie lubes her up with more alcohol. Jamie says there were approximately 68 people there, last he counted, not counting the kids.
Yeah, but how hard is that,
the
though?
The little boy Jamie asleep on the hay. Sorry, what?
How hard is that to keep track of that? He's like, people coming in, people going out. I think there's about 68 people, but I'm not counting everyone.
I would just call it like, okay, I'm going to start right here. I'm going to start people. Yeah, I'm just going to start and go with it and explain that this is not exact because people are going in and out, but this is my best thing. Yeah, I'm not going to. I wouldn't worry about it because, yeah, it would be difficult. Bree and Roger are enjoying their evening dancing. So dancing. Mr. Weems is doling out cider. Lizzing is holding court on a hay bale, quote, surrounded by four or five gawky boys who were all behaving very much like the dancers round the cider tub, unquote. And as ever, people are trying to match make for Lizzie. Claire notices a tall boy, Jakob Schnell, who had come with the mullahs. Evidently, for the purpose of seeing Lizzie. But Jamie says that the boy is Lutheran and his family would not let him marry a Catholic. So even Jamie and Claire, I mean, they're kind of their caretaker, so I get it. But everyone's all up in the Lizzie, or they're talking about who wants to be all up in the Lizzie. Martina P. writes, what a great celebration on the ridge. Even the Germans with good quality shoes traveled for more than 30 miles to attend the festivities. The big house must have been the place to be on Hogmanay, and I just love their sense of community and then everyone celebrates together. I pity the poor devils that did not get an invite, or she said evite. Martina, how did the Frasers feed everyone, or was it more of a potluck? It sure sounds like everyone had a wonderful time. It was funny to read about Lizzie holding court on a hay bale while Jamie and Clara were playing matchmaker. I so often wonder about the size of Jamie's brain. Even on extremely rare occasions when he does not know a person's name, he for sure can list the names of family members and their circumstances. I admire an ability because it is embarrassing how I stink at remembering people's names. Then Evan Lindsay calls for Jamie to show everyone how the sword dance is done. He calls him, and so do others, McDo. Jamie didn't really wanna, but their calls kept coming. They take him to the floor. He's prepping, and Ronnie lays out the two swords. And Jamie does the sword dance.
Do you get a lot of UTIs? Turns out you're not alone. UTIs are the second most common infection in the U.S. Half of all women get UTIs, and about 1 in 5 women struggle with recurring UTIs.
If you get UTIs, you know that cranberry juice is useless, and taking too many antibiotics can be problematic. So what should you do? Try Eucora, the natural, effective way to prevent UTIs.
Eucora was developed using the best research available in collaboration with a team of physicians. Eucora's unique formula targets bacteria and enables you to safely flush bacteria out of your urinary tract, stopping UTIs before they can start.
Just mix it with water and drink it after intimacy or exercise, or whenever you think you might be at risk of a UTI. If you don't know what causes your UTIs, Eucora has you covered on a day-to-day basis, too. It's made with ingredients found in nature, and it tastes like pink lemonade.
Eucora also makes a specialized probiotic, Eucora Promote, which includes two specific strains of good bacteria that your body needs to keep bad bacteria in check. Eucora Promote balances pH and restores good bacteria that keeps your system healthy. Just take one capsule a day to ward off UTIs and other nasty issues like yeast infections and BV.
Try Eucora to break free from the endless cycle of UTIs. Eucora's founder used to struggle with UTIs herself, so she knows what it's like to be stuck in the cycle. That's why Eucora has a money-back guarantee. They really want to help, and if you aren't happy with Eucora, they don't want you to be stuck with something you don't want. Try Eucora, and if you aren't happy within 30 days, they'll give you your money back.
Try Eucora risk-free for 30 days and say goodbye to UTIs. And right now, Eucora is offering 30% off when you text OUTLANDER to 484848. But hurry, this is a limited-time offer.
Text OUTLANDER to 484848 and get 30% off your order of Eucora. That's OUTLANDER to 484848. Now, okay, Summer, who does this remind you of? Quote, there was an outburst of clapping nearby, and I saw Brianna put two fingers in her mouth and give an ear-splitting whistle of approbation to the marked shock of the people standing next to her, unquote.
It's really obnoxious. I apologize in advance to anyone near me at any kind of an event where I feel it is warranted.
I think it's a great skill to have. It's just, you got to give people warning because I can't, at least to plug your ears, because yeah, it's awful. It's amazing and it's awful.
Here's the warning. If you're with me at a sporting event or at an Outlander themed event and there may or may not be cast members coming out on stage, I'm going to do it.
But see, to me, that is less shocking because everyone's, you know, it's a loud environment, right? And everyone is excited and screaming and yelling and cheering. That doesn't shock me. What shocks me is when we're somewhere where it's maybe not that type of place or event, but, and again, not incorrectly, I think it's a skill that can be appropriately used and applied. And I think being part of a crowd, a cheering crowd is completely appropriate. It may startle me, but that doesn't bother me. What freaks me the freak out and hurts is when we're in, like, I don't know, not like it's the five of us in family, but like we're at a, you know, an outdoor event or something like that, and there's a group and people are trying to get someone's attention and people aren't really paying attention. And so you're like, okay, here, let me help. And then you do your thing and I don't have that much notice, or I don't know that you're doing it, or my back is to you or whatever. And then I hear it and I'm just like, holy crap. I think you did it at Comic-Con when we were outside meeting for that picture or something with Sarah and them.
I may have, to get everyone's attention. I mean, that's really the only reason for it ever, is to get somebody's attention.
So a Highland sword dance was done for one of three reasons: for exhibition and entertainment, as he was about to do it now, for competition, as was done among the young men at a gathering, and as it was first done as an omen, danced on the eve of a battle. The skill of the dancer foretold success or failure. The young men had danced between cross swords the night before Preston Pans, before Falkirk, but not before Culloden. There had been no campfires the night before the final fight, no time for bards and battle songs. It didn't matter. No one had needed an omen then. Unquote. So Jamie had done it as a competition himself, and then on the eves of battles in the Highlands as well as in France. And, quote, for the Lindsays to know his skill, he must have also danced at Ardsmuir. Unquote. And that kind of, that surprised me. I don't think I ever thought about him doing that at Ardsmuir, but that's true. He would have, for them to have known it and to have called him, they would have had to seen it or knew that he did it.
He wouldn't have had any swords. So what do you think he could have used in Ardsmuir?
Rats.
To do his sword dance. You don't know. Rats wouldn't
work. A few
work.
Rats make a long one.
I mean, they're not allowed any weapons, so they probably couldn't have sticks either. So I'm like,
the pieces of their,
like, belts.
I mean,
like
belts,
they lay the
yeah.
belts down, maybe?
I mean, that's pieces of their tartan they're not allowed to wear.
It's a tartan they're not supposed to have with them.
Like, roll it out, unroll it. Susanna M. writes, I would love to see Jamie's sword dance on the show. Do you think I jinxed it by mentioning the subject? I didn't realize that there were other musicians in the Ridge, and I love reading about the bagpipes. Well, Susanna, I think when Summer says, now that we've said that, they're not going to do it, I think she's talking about her and I, right, Summer?
Because when I mention that anytime we say this has to be in,
yes,
that it never is.
But you're talking about us, right? Not contributors.
I mean, they could very well be them as well. I mean, I don't want to take all the credit for things not being put in the show.
No, but all the credit for the things you're blaming for not being put in the show. That was her idea. I never said that. I'm not necessarily saying it's wrong. Yeah. So Martina P. writes, Jamie was coerced by possibly his Ardsmuir Jacobites to perform the Highland sword dance. Brianna gives a whistle for her father, which draws strange glances from the guests, but a smile from her father, and then his eyes find Claire in the crowd. I utterly adore Claire's description of Jamie's body language and her interesting and educational thoughts during the performance. I can visualize it so vividly, to the point that I see Sam Hewen dancing like a graceful warrior with a look of unutterable distance in his eyes. I gotta ask. I just gotta ask. Do you think they're gonna? Well, this is book five. Like, sorry, we're so far. This is the problem with doing a read along and of a certain book, and then, you know, which is a pretty, for reading, for listening, it's fair enough, but for reading, it's a pretty slow pace. Come on. I just finished book seven on my own personal read throughs, and I'll be going on to book eight soon, but. I'm getting things so confused. I was like, we're on book seven. No, we're not. We're on book five, Ginger. That's hard. Okay, so do you think they would keep something like that for book I guess it is five. For book five?
The sword dancing?
Yeah.
Honestly, no.
I honestly don't even know if they're going to have Hogmanay.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to be struggling to have much of the gathering.
Oh, Lord.
So if we cut the gathering out, we have to cut a bunch of other things out. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know.
I just thought
we'll
of something.
Find out together.
Okay, so
February.
I will not name any names. First of all, I don't know them, and I'm not going to stop recording or whatever to go look at Facebook and see who said this. But this made me laugh. I don't know if you saw it. So if you listen to our show, you know what my feelings are with regard, and many other people too, not just me. Maybe I'm just the most vocal with regard to the timeline of that cabin, right? Okay. So keep that in the back of your mind. We were posting about, you know, in our Facebook group today, outlanderpod.com/group.
Got to get that plug in.
Well, hey, got to do it. Sharing the good news that we had a premiere date. So we're like, yay, everyone's so happy, blah, 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 blah. So I think I shared at least one post, and I know other people posted about it too. So on one of the posts, there were all these comments, and I jumped in. Someone said something about, I don't know what it was about. I think the post had to do with the premiere, right? The premiere date. But the comment that I made was something about, you could still read between the lines, not even between the lines. You could, I was not hiding the fact that I said something like, okay, the comment or a picture. Oh, I shared a picture, the picture they shared with Sam, Katrina, and Sophie looking off at something, which is the only picture they gave us today with the date on it. I shared the picture and people were like, oh, I wonder whether, but you know, people were just talking about how happy they were, what they saw in the picture or didn't see, whatever. And someone, I think, said something to the effect of, it's going to be a long time, or I know what it was. They said, they said something like, Sam's hair, Jamie's hair looks great. I'm glad. It's like Jamie has long enough. He took long enough to grow his
bangs out. I'm pretty sure that was Lindsay.
Okay. So then I replied something like, well, how do we know? What do we know? Maybe they took 3 years to do that, because I don't believe anything they tell us with regard to timelines because of what they tell. They told us this cabin was at a month and a half, you know, BS. So I made a joke like, well, I don't believe anything. So for all I know, it could be 3 years and we're going to get a young Jem who is celebrating his third birthday. And someone pipes in, like, this is why I think you missed it. Someone said, I think they sprinkled the same thing on Jamie's hair that they did on the cabin to make it grow fast. You don't think that's funny?
It's fine. I think...
ridiculous.
I think structurally for the storyline, they left on such a cliffhanger that they kind of have to pick up where they left off. They can have a time passage happen thereafter, but I don't think that they can drop it with him receiving that missive telling him to bring Murta to justice or whatever, and then have them just be like, nope, forget about it, we're at the gathering, woohoo.
Well, what you're saying is they can't pick up with Jamie with nice bangs. That's what you're saying. Because unless they, like you're saying, unless they, if he has nice bangs in season 5, or long bangs, whatever.
So is this like Becky with the good hair from Lemonade?
I have no idea who Becky is.
Oh, Ginger.
Or Lemonade. Is it a song?
It was an album by Beyonce.
Yeah, I don't have a lot of Beyonce. I just don't listen to her.
Jay-Z cheating on her with Becky with the good hair. So it became a viral thing. Everyone was discussing who Becky with the good hair was.
Oh.
And so it was Becky with the good hair. So is this going to be Jamie with the good bangs?
I guess. Maybe. I don't think, but there's no cheating involved. So I don't know. So just before midnight, this is back in chapter 35. Just before midnight, the crowd dissipates. People are heading to the house for snacks and drinks and to, I guess, be indoors in the proper place before the first footing. Mrs. Bug had a basket of apples to give the young unmarried girls to divine the names of their husbands. Now, Claire took Jem up to bed and comes back to see Lizzie's apple peel, which was in the shape of a J. Ha ha. Susanna M. Okay, Susanna, just so you know, I'm not going to bleep it out because it's too much work after the fact, but I will bleep myself. I will bleep part of your comment as I read it, because I don't know if you didn't realize it was a spoiler, but I will leave out the spoilers, okay? This is what Susanna M. wrote about that. Lizzie got a J. Mrs. Bug confirmed it. One could think of John or even Ian. I remember the beep, beep. One of them is named Beep. But it's just a superstition. It's like, dang, Susanna.
You didn't even get the justice of a car horn or a bicycle horn. You're going to do those high-pitched beeps?
Yes, Summer. Okay. The other ones are high pitched too. What are you talking about? It's just more work in the after, not after show, in the after whatever.
Afterbirth? What?
Stop. Bree beckons Claire. Roger's ready to go out, but she needs the salt. Claire goes to her surgery to get it. As a tall, handsome man with dark hair, Roger was good luck for first footing. To welcome as the first footer across one's threshold after midnight brought good luck for the coming year. The tenants who lived nearby went to their houses to eagerly await Roger as first footer. A red-haired man was bad luck. Hey,
red-haired man.
Quote, Jamie had been consigned to his study under the riotous guard of the Lindsay brothers, who were to keep him safely bottled up until after midnight, unquote. Martina P. writes, I love that Roger met the requirement for first footing and was able to have such a positive role in bringing in the new year on Fraser's Ridge. I always find myself cheering for Roger when he has an opportunity to collect some brownie points with Jamie. As a professor, he certainly does not have the skill set needed for the 18th century, unlike his wife, so it always makes me happy when he can shine in his very own way. I wonder why Roger didn't get...
For having black hair.
Yeah. And she concludes, I wonder why Roger didn't perform during the festivities. And I'm going to say, I agree. When I was first reading this, I'm like, oh, well, and I can't say what it is, but I thought, oh, he's not singing or playing because... is not in existence yet. And so there is no reason, right, for him not to sing.
On New Year's?
Yeah.
I mean,
they got all the music going on. Come on.
I'm at the first footing. Have we gone back in time?
No. Martina was saying she loves that Roger gets to be the first footer. She likes that he gets to do things that other people can't. She likes it when he gets opportunities. But she also says at the end of that comment, she wonders why he hadn't performed at the festivities.
There's no saying that he didn't. I mean, just because they didn't say that he did doesn't mean that he didn't.
I don't think he did, because Diana went out of her way to say that he and Brianna were dancing and having a good time. And maybe that was the whole point. Mm-hmm. You know, if they had enough people to actually do the entertainment, then, you know, then why? Because Jem was asleep for the most part. And they enjoyed themselves. And I think she even said something along the lines of, like, they had a rare night. I mean, they were actually obviously not alone, but they had an entertaining evening. Susanna M. writes, I had never heard of the custom of the first house visitor, first footing, before reading this chapter. It's a superstition, but it's nice of Roger to be willing to do his part in bringing good luck for the new year in Fraser's Ridge. And I think it's sweet that Roger is taking Bree along despite the fact that she's a redhead, which brings bad luck in on Hogmanay. So the plan is Bree is to accompany Roger as he goes around, but she will not be entering, at least definitely not first. Quote, first foot was to bring gifts. So the person who did, or the guy, Roger, first foot was to bring gifts to the house, quote, an egg, a piece of wood, a bit of salt, and some whiskey. Claire, who is still looking for the salt, opens a cabinet and comes eyeball to eyeball with Adso, who is nestling the remains of a mouse. She gets the salt. Roger asks her about this, quote, wee old wifey. It's the small figurine that Mrs. Bug had given Claire. So I'm guessing it was just sitting out there. That I didn't understand, or I didn't remember reading. I guess Claire had just left it out and he sees it. He confirms to Claire that it is indeed very old, and Bree moves in to see, and Claire stops her from touching it, just in case. Bree doesn't touch it, and Roger is looking at her, quote, with an odd intensity. I could almost imagine that he was willing her to touch the thing as strongly as I was willing her not to. Unquote. So Claire scoops it up and puts it in her pocket. It's time to go. Martina P. writes, I was a little surprised that Claire didn't want Brianna to touch the fertility charm. I didn't think she was superstitious, but it makes me wonder what her motives are. Do you want to say anything? Go ahead.
I know. This is true of any new mother. She's just got a new baby, right? For me, as a non-time traveler, it's...
Wait, really?
I know. I'm out of the diapers phase. I don't want to go back. I don't want to start all over again, right? Whereas with Brie, it is every day she's not pregnant is a day closer to maybe them as a family going back through the stones. And the more babies she has, the more chance that she never leaves.
That is also true. But I think more so than her being stuck, every time she gets pregnant and goes through with a pregnancy and has a baby, her chances of dying increase. Even though she, you know, from what we understand, she had a smooth, not easy. No, I don't think any delivery is necessary. By definition, is not easy. But she didn't have, she seemed to not have had major complications as far as, you know, not needing a C-section. The baby wasn't, you know, there was no cord problems or, you know, positioning, all that. It is absolutely true. But I think before you get to having that fourth or fifth child, you have to have the second, right? And every time, or not even the number, before a child can be a certain age, before you might take it through the stones or have a chance or have an idea to maybe consider having the option of going back to your own time. I think more of an immediate danger is her surviving childbirth in the 18th century. So I think Claire was like, anything, I think you're not wrong. I think you're also right. But I think anything.
Well, I'm big picturing it. And I think you're very specific. And that's cool because they're both true.
You're thinking of, like you said, long game. You're thinking of her having an out. Her and Roger and whatever kids they have having an out. And every time there's another baby or child,
you start the clock all over again.
Absolutely. I don't disagree. And I'm thinking, and you're right. These are both true at the same time. They're both true. And I'm just thinking, oh my God, yeah, let's worry about getting her through the pregnancy first and the birth. And then you're absolutely right. Because as soon as my thing is faced and she's safely through her labor, then your thing comes about and you're like, well, we're back at square one. So they're both 100% true. Susanna M. writes, this chapter is, back to Martina, when she said, I think Summer and I both explained what our opinions are, but as far as Claire and superstition and that little fertility symbol, or not symbol, I mean, it was a symbol, but the little fertility figure, I don't think she wants any, she doesn't want to give any help. If, you know what I'm saying? Like, touching that figure will not impregnate you. Obviously, you have to have sex with a man. But if there's even a little bit of a chance that it can, you know, I don't know, affect your mindset and therefore your body to be more receptive or open or I don't know, whatever. She's like, I don't want to take a blinking chance. I don't even want to like, I don't know. So yeah, I don't think that Claire is not, I would say Claire's less superstitious in general than the Highlanders. Absolutely. But this is her daughter, her only child, her only physical living child and or biological child. And she's not taking any, she doesn't want to take any chances. I think that's why.
I mean, and wasn't she asking her previously for birth control?
Back at the gathering time. Yeah. They talked about.
And that's not that long ago.
Actually, that may have even been book four. Yeah. There was a sponge involved with oil, hyssop or something like that. A sponge and oil and also some Queen Anne's lace. Yeah.
So knowing that at this point, as far as she knows, Brie is also not wanting to have more bibbis.
Yeah.
Don't touch it.
Susanna M. writes, this chapter is full of superstitions. I was a bit surprised that Claire reacted so strongly to the charm. I didn't think she had that superstitious. She was that superstitious. And since Mrs. Bug had it for many years and never did have a child, I wouldn't think Brie just touching it once would be important. But clearly, Claire's reaction was instinctive, given the dangers of childbirth in this time. Now, that's a good point regarding how do you answer that, Summer, about Mrs. Bug? Because it's true. The dude, the whatever his name was, who gave her the one she gave all the money they had to this guy to give her this little charm, correct, this little figure. And the guy said, basically, your choice is have a child, like here's this figure, use it or keep it, and it will help you have a child, carry a child to term, but you will lose your husband. or she could not do anything with it and keep her husband and never have a child or carry it to term. So I guess what we're missing is, and this is, I guess, what it comes down to, Susanna, is that we aren't privy to the steps that were going to have to be taken with it, whether it was you put it under your pillow, you sleep with it, you dance naked in the moonlight. We don't know what it was, but whatever it was, it certainly wasn't simply owning it because it never happened, right? But there was something, maybe not magical or like maybe not doing anything with it physically, but there was something that she was supposed to do. I'm sure of it. If she truly wanted to go that way.
It was a prayer.
Because whatever it was, she didn't do
it. It's like a prayer or a, oh, like maybe a chant or something she was supposed to say.
Okay. So see, I forgot that part. So yeah, there was something else that she had to do besides just owning that figurine. Claire has a Claire moment. She feels stillness, something shifting. So she's given this all to Roger. Roger and Bree have left, and all the people have gone back to, if they're close, have gone back to their homes to await Roger for as first footer. And Jamie is, I think, just not quite let out of the, it's still not quite midnight. Jamie's not quite let out of the his office. And it's almost midnight. And Claire knows that it is, there's, scientifically speaking, to the best of our knowledge, like there's no, nothing happens on January 1st or December 31st, whatever. Like time ticks by, but nothing happens from one moment to the next that makes something, you know, huge or movable or time any different other than time has passed. However, she, as a very earthy creature, a very sensual somewhat and sensual person and someone who feels things as a time traveler, and it seems to be quite connected to the earth, connected to herself, and connected to healing and all of that. She feels the stillness and she feels something shifting. Things that have no meaning yet do because we give them meaning. Now this made me think, and I'm not going to go on about it because it's, I don't even know if you've read it, and even if you have read it or watched it, we could just go on for way too long about it. But that little stanza or that little those lines there by Diana made me think of American Gods. Now, you don't have to have read or watched the adaptation, but the thing about the whole point of American Gods, or at least one of the points, is that there's old gods and new gods. And the reason any god has power in any culture in the world is because we've assigned it power, right? So when that culture dies out, well, this is for American gods. When a culture dies out, their god still exists as far as, you know, this, at least in history, there's a name. And this, as far as assigning like, oh, this culture in Sumeria worshipped these gods or this god, right? Like we can look in history books or anthropological texts and see, read about other cultures and their deities. But does it mean that because those cultures are thousands of years that they've died out, that those gods are no longer in existence, right? Because don't they have to be prayed to, worshipped, whatever?
Well, that's what gives them power.
Exactly. And that's what, and giving power and giving a name is what makes people real. I mean, it's almost like take it to the Velveteen Rabbit, right? So I just, this little stanza of Diana's made me think of American Gods and how the whole thing with the old gods versus the new gods is that different societies had, well, specifically American Gods, it was like, whether it was Africa, whether it was, I don't know if they showed an Asian example, but definitely African, definitely the different European gods, the Norse gods, the Celtic gods, I think Celtic, I'm not sure, but they had come over with their, with the immigrants, right? So the old, literally played on the whole old world, new world themes. And when people left their old world, the old world, to come to the new world, they did bring their gods with them. You know, they brought some practice with them. They brought the old country with them. But after generations, like maybe 100 years, 80 years, as society changes and things happen more, you know, in the new place, the people who originally brought the old gods with them, you know, their children's children didn't necessarily worship the same.
And it also becomes like a game of telephone.
Telephone?
Yeah, because a lot of these things are handed down orally, right?
The really old stuff, yeah.
Oral traditions and things. Yeah, so over time,
things tend to shift in the tellings. So a lot of things don't remain the
same. That's true.
So,
I mean, and they mix. They mix.
And it's just like how things are, you know, retold by conquering factions. Like all of the pagan holidays are now Christian holidays, but they've been renamed, reconfigured, and repurposed as pagan light. It made them, the pagans coming over into the Christian religions, feel more comfortable, you know, kind of sidling over and becoming Christians because, oh, look, we all kind of celebrate the same things, same holidays.
Yeah, I think, and I'm not saying it that that's never the case, but a lot of time in my understanding and reading of the expansion of Christianity, it's not that pagan holidays suddenly became Christian holidays. It's that the expanding historical Roman Catholic Church, right? That was a big part of Western culture for a long time, or, you know, up through through the Reformation, right? Was the Christian, like that was the dominant Christian power or religion, was Catholicism in the West, at least. And yes, but early, it's like, so thousands of years ago, 2000 years ago, not like 1,000 years ago, when Christianity spread, and they came to an area, you know, a new area, or they conquered a new area, and so they had the local cultures, pagan cultures, had their own holidays. Many pagan cultures had, you know, their holidays, their sacred times were understandably based on the wheel of the year, right? The changing of the seasons, the equinoxes, solstices, etc. Things that were astrologically and physically observable. So that to them was real, because that is real, right? Those are real, actually. So these days, now the meaning that was attributed to them and the beliefs that people had about these days were of their own culture. But yeah, so a lot of times because we're speaking about Christianity, the Catholic Church would come over and maybe not necessarily target and say, okay, they have these 8 days, so we need to have something on these 8 days. But if the church had a certain celebration that was around the same time or had a similar, you know, like background or similar meaning or similar emphasis, I guess, then absolutely they would not necessarily do like tit for tat, like say, okay, well, they had these 8, so we got to have 8 to they'll come over. But to definitely along the lines of what you said, as far as it made it, I don't say more palpable, because if you're a conquered people, you don't really have a lot of choice, but it made it more, they were smart in what they did, right? The Roman Catholic Church or the conquerors, because if you conquer a people, or if you go into an area where this culture already has certain customs and already has, and you're saying, okay, you must now practice this religion, and you take everything away from them, it's going to be a lot harder than if you give them something that seems to appease that or seems kind of along the lines, right? Especially in subsequent generations. The initial generation is going to be like the toughest. But yeah, they definitely took advantage of that. Absolutely.
But I think it's worth noting that I am not a biblical scholar.
Neither am I.
So take everything I just said with the grain of she might not know what the hell she's talking about.
Oh, stop.
So.
Well, neither of us are. I have done, it is an interest of mine. So I have done a lot of reading, and a friend of ours she's a classicist, which means she studied ancient Roman, ancient Greece, and Latin and Greek are her languages, but she has studied not necessarily through her classic studies, although they definitely fall in line with that, through her, I guess, not prerequisites, what do you call it when you're electives? Through electives and through things. Actually, one of the classes that I actually met her in, I met her at a local junior college before she even started working on her bachelor's. But the teacher who taught the class where I met her taught another class about basically the reading. She taught Old Testament and New Testament, I think, but it was about how to read, not literally read, but how to read the Old Testament and New Testament in the context of the time they were written, right? And so not reading them with today's eyes, reading them with eyes for the, like, who were they written for? What language were they written in? You know, who was the audience? Because the audience, whom you're writing to or for, will completely depend, or how you phrase something or your message completely depends on your audience. And that is not something, you know, Summer and I grew up going to, you know, the odd Sunday school, you know, attended church somewhat regularly as when we were very young, but definitely not when we were, you know, much older. But yeah, I will just say that. And predominantly, you would agree, predominantly fundamentalist Protestant churches, right, Sam?
I mean, Baptist.
Yeah, fundamental Protestant churches. So
you're using terms that I don't speak.
Okay, Protestant meaning non-Catholic, right? And
sure.
Fundamental is typically used when, at least in a Christian Protestant tradition, because you can have fundamentalists of anything, but in the Protestant Christian tradition, a fundamentalist, in my understanding, typically means someone or a group of people, right, a sect, whatever, who reads, for example, reads the Bible or understands the Bible to be literal, or understand it or explain it literally. And not just as an inspired word of God, but as the inspired word of God that is literally every single word is literally true, not figurative in any way. So anyway, and that's a whole other side thing that we're not going to go into. But anyway, that's how we were, not how we were brought up, but that's what I was exposed to when we did go to these different churches. And so when my friend, her name is Danielle, she studies the classics, she's a classicist, and she and I met, as I said, in a class by a teacher who taught these other classes about how to read the Bible, the Old and New Testaments, not necessarily correctly, but how to read them as they were meant in the context of the target audience and the time and the world in which they were written. So I find that fascinating, and I think it's so important to, and I forget all the time, but it's so important to remember, if you're ever reading something like, you know, an ancient document, and I know this kind of gets off with my tangent was, I said Claire feels something shifting, right? And then we talked about the older religions or older cultures, pagan cultures, having certain holidays and the Christian church or the Catholic church coming in and, you know, kind of putting a holiday on top of their holidays. And there is, it's not far, far off the mark. It's not as simple as, you know, here's one, like a tit for tat kind of thing, but it is definitely inspired by that as far as, you know, wanting to take advantage of this framework that already existed or these certain holy days so that at least having a celebration around this time or for this type of purpose wasn't, even if the person celebrated or the saint or the whatever was different, the fact that the same type of holy person or, you know, fairy, whatever, was celebrated or adored, there was some kind of commonality to it. So I guess to make that transition a little easier, make it more palatable, more acceptable. But yeah, American Gods, definitely check it out. It's on Stars too. It's midnight and there's no Roger. They're like, where's Roger? And then there are some small knocks. But instead of Roger and Bree, it's the Bobbsey twins.
Have you forgotten their names?
No, I just said Bobbsey twins because it was fun. Beardsleys. Thankfully, people thought that twin brunette males were a good omen, bringing twice the luck. Which leads to talk about the Beardsleys. No one knew what the twins had been doing between the militia's expedition to Brownsville and now. But people talked, and some of them danced some more. People who were not going home that night or who were sticking around or didn't dance slept in corners or where they could find a spot. Claire goes to see Jamie, who is in his office, holding a paper in his hands. It's a design of a house, actually, for the Chisholms. Now, it's meant to be a gift for Brianna, and here's how it goes. Ronnie Sinclair, who had a large cabin, agreed to move into his, like, a little shed cabin area, into his Cooper's shop. The Chisholms would move into Ronnie's cabin, and they, probably not the Chisholms, but people on the ridge, Jamie, Roger, others, I'm guessing, would help add on two more rooms to his cabin. In return, Mrs. Chisholm would cook for Ronnie and do his laundry. And when spring came, when the Chisholms got their own land and could build a house, Ronnie would get back his newly enlarged cabin, which would hopefully give him a better chance of getting a wife, attracting a wife, keeping a wife, and Roger and Bree would get their own cabin back. Lizzie and her dad would get their room back, and as Claire says, quote, "and everything is beer and Skittles," unquote. Now, have you ever heard that, Sam? Had you ever heard that?
No, I didn't, and I was concerned that I was going to have to Google it, but then
she explained it.
She went in and explained it, and then it just made me kind of laugh a little bit more because I'm like, we named it candy Skittles. Not we personally, but America named candy Skittles. And that's not so in my brain, Skittles are fruit flavored.
Rainbow. Taste
hard,
the rainbow.
Chewy candies. Yeah, taste the rainbow. And she's talking about like it sounds like bowling pins.
Yeah, I looked it up. Idioms.thefreedictionary.com. And their definition, I guess, of that phrase is all fun and pleasure. Or easy and pleasant. And then in parentheses, Skittles is the game of nine pins, a game similar to bowling. And this phrase is a fixed phrase or idiom. So yeah, so it sounds like it is a game like bowling. And to say something like beer and Skittles, it's like I'm guessing people would drink beer as they played nine pins or Skittles. But now it makes me want to say beer and Skittles.
Feel free. But you neither drink beer nor do you bowl.
No. I mean, I like Skittles, but I don't really own them. I don't have them often. But I definitely don't like beer. And by the way, Summer, I think I talked to you about it. I talked to our parents about it. I don't know. I was just lamenting the fact. I'm not super disappointed or anything. I was just like, oh, man. And I have come to, not a decision, but a realization. I think I already knew it or realized it, but I finally am owning up to it. Summer's right. I don't really like beer. I'm not really a wine person. It's just not, it's a little bit too bitter. Yet we all know I like whiskey and I like frou-frou drinks and mixed drinks.
Boggles my mind.
I know, right? Seriously. But I've also had to face hard facts or the hard truth that I legit can't stand gin. I just can't.
Well, I'll tell you what. I've been pretty clear about my dislike for whiskey over the years. I really want to like it. I can't be more clear about that. I don't really. However, Sam Heughan, if you're listening, you're
oh,
not.
Oh, gosh.
But if you're listening,
don't be negative.
I would love for you to ship me some of your Sam Heughan whiskey.
And by her, she means me. Don't be a doof.
No, I'm just saying.
Us.
I'd like, what if this is the whiskey? What if this is the one?
It's Summer. It's not.
It's not.
You're
right. It's not.
It's not. It's the fire burning flame retardant taste of any whiskey. The burning. It's because here's the thing. Even the whiskeys that I love, the more the sweet ones, right? That have like a honey taste or a chocolate taste or an almond taste. The ones that are not Ashy Peaty Smoky Mossy. So the ones that I really like. Still kick the out of my throat and my stomach. So, but their good taste is enough, at least to my palate, to overcome that. The rest, no. Because I just know. So it's just it's just so interesting. I know everyone has a different palate. I totally get it. And someone else who likes whiskey will like different ones than I do. I get it. It's just so interesting to me, like, that I can really like certain whiskeys so much and they're so smooth, so good. And I almost can't stand anything else unless it's like a frou-frou drink, like pina coladas. Like I can drink those, well, not all night because I'll be on my booty, but you know what I mean? If it's really sweet and like sugary, which is obviously so healthy, like those, and those are the most dangerous ones because you drink them and then you're like on your ass before you know it. But yeah, I just find it I still find it kind of mind-boggling that I can say I like whiskey, which is, you know, one of the harder drinks, but I don't like beer or wine or gin. Yeah. So it's a mystery. Martina P. writes, Claire finds Jamie in the study, and I always enjoy their alone time and conversations. It seems that Jamie and Roger have been plotting to regain privacy with their spouses as the new housing plan makes perfect sense. That's funny. I didn't think about the Jamie and Claire part. I just thought about the Roger and Bree.
I mean, it's a really well thought out plan.
It's, yeah. And here we find out what happened to Jamie's ear for music, to whatever extent he had one. And Claire points out that an ear for music and an aptitude for mathematics often go together. It was quite soon before he met her. So really close to the point where he met her is what Diana means. He'd been in France on his way back with Dougal et al. When Myrta had come up on her, meaning Claire, in her shift when she was running through the Highlands, right? Beginning of episode 101. It had been the head wound. Jamie had had a head wound at that point. At that point, it was mostly, it was predominantly healed. But, quote, it was no more now than a thread. The welted gash healed to a hairbreadth line. Still, it had been an 8-inch wound laid open with an axe. It had nearly killed him at the time. He'd lain near death in a French abbey for 4 months and suffered from crippling headaches for years, unquote. After that, he says, he could no longer hear music, only rhythm. He's pretty sure it was Dougal who'd done it. He knew for sure. He realizes that Claire, however, hadn't understood what Dougal had said as he died.
Well, she hadn't heard him.
Quote, well, she hadn't understood it. It was in Gaelic. Well, yeah, probably didn't hear him either, but she didn't understand it at that point. Quote, sister, son, or no, I would that I had killed you that day on the hill, for I knew from the beginning that it would be you or me, unquote. Now, I have a question for you, Summer.
No.
Did they keep that in the show?
No. Pretty sure that's...
He said something, but it wasn't that, right?
I don't think that's what he said. I can look.
In the show?
Pull it up right now. Yeah. Give me a second.
Guys, they didn't keep diddle squat. I almost said diddle squirt, but that's kind of gross. They didn't keep diddle squat of that. And I'm not even talking about like the storyline. They didn't even, Dougal didn't say doodle.
No, he was breathing. He's dying. He was pretty focused on dying.
Martina P. writes, Claire and Jamie are unwinding. And during another conversation, we learned the reason why Jamie cannot hear music anymore. We experienced many nostalgic thoughts and memories of the past with Jamie thinking of Dougal and stating that he had made his peace with him. Claire was surprised to learn that Dougal had attempted to kill Jamie. Susanna M. writes, I really love this chapter. I love the sense of community. It's one of those few times when you're reading about the lies at the Ridge and everything is going so well. People are celebrating and the whole atmosphere is of pure happiness. These are the moments when you think, how will Diana destroy all this?
I have a pretty good idea.
That's because you've read it. Hush.
Yes.
Oh, Summer. Martina P. writes, it was very fascinating to learn about the different Hogmanay traditions like first footing and the apple peeling in this chapter. I was born and raised in a country full of old and many traditions, but none are similar to the Scottish ones on New Year's. This holiday seems more important to the Scots than Christmas. Extremely interesting, and I wonder how many of these old traditions are still observed in modern Scotland. This makes me want to suggest a pod abroad Hogmanay trip. I'm just saying, a girl can dream. The chapter perfectly ends with Jamie's declaration, the past is gone, the future is not come, and we are here together, you and I, unquote. Doesn't this say it all? And Susanna M. closes us out with, I love the alone times between Jamie and Claire. The simplicity and honesty they have with each other is unique. The revelation that Jamie knew Dougal tried to kill him is important to resolve the memory of Dougal's death. Jamie explains to Claire why he cannot hear the music any longer, only the beat. Jamie's recollection of this event provides the reference for the for this part title, quote, "I hear no music but the sound of drums," unquote.
And that was chapter 35. Join us next time when we will be discussing multiple chapters. We will be doing three chapters, 36, Worlds Unseen, 37, Mail Call, and 38, entitled The Dream Time. And we still have a few more chapters available to sign up to contribute for. If you are interested in becoming a read-along contributor, you can go to www.outlanderpod.com/fierycross.
Join us to help us continue the conversation in our Facebook community. You can meet us. You can find us at outlanderpod.com/group. And help support content you believe in, content that is made exclusively for our listeners. Support us on Patreon. You can find out more about that at patreon.com/outlanderpod. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.